Okay, so the Torah begins the discussion of Tsaras. The Torah begins the discussion of Tsaras, and it uses the term Adam, a person when he has Tsaras. The word Adam in the Torah usually connotes someone of importance, someone of distinction, right? That's why first man was called Adam, something important. Now the question is, here we're talking about a sinner, right? Tsaras is a spiritual leprosy that is a person gets as a divine message that he's not being all he could be. That divine and that may be usually associated with speaking ill of another person. It could be associated with soros ayin, says the Gemara, if a person has a begrudging eye on another individual. It reflects the negative inner character traits are coming out. It exposes itself on the outside, right? Right? Disease in general, right? A person has, God forbid, disease on the inside, physical disease. It manifests itself at times outside.
Well, how does that manifest itself to childbirth?
No, the childbirth is not connected at all. That we'll discuss, actually. That's something I have to conclude that. How it's connected. No, his question is good. I'll discuss that in a minute, but 1 minute.
What did you ask?
Yes. Yes.
No.
How come we don't have that now?
Oh, you know, very good. So Ruth wants to know a very good question. Ruth is throwing into the mix. I don't see anybody with Tsaras today.
No.
Why not?
No, they say because we don't have the Beis HaMikdash.
So maybe we don't have the Beis HaMikdash, that's one, but still the temple.
Okay.
We don't have the temple with all of the offerings that could be brought. That's true. But remember that the mitzvahs at least should still manifest itself.
You're right.
Why should there not be the spiritual manifestation of that item?
Maybe cancer? It's
a warning. No, it's a warning.
It's a warning, but it's specific. It's specific. It's a spiritual disease with physical manifestation. We don't have it today. Why not? So on that, right? The answer is, well, let's first see, why does it use the word Adam? Why does it use the word, our first question, why does it use an important person's name, right? Someone of distinction, and why is it not around today?
Doesn't Adam mean also like humanity?
Yes. But it's usually used from a little bit of importance. So an answer is given that the idea why we're choosing the word Adam is because this message is sent to someone who's already ready to hear the message. Because what happens when a person gets Tsaras? He has to go to the Kohen. And he has to ask the Kohen, shh, did you bring the stuff? Okay, she's here. She can bring it out. They were doing a surprise for you. They didn't know if they could do it. Okay, we'll finish the Dvar Torah, and then we'll break for the... Okay.
Did you go all the way to New York?
Okay.
You're coming, your mom's birthday, right?
My mom's coming, so we're going to celebrate everybody's birthday.
Good.
Okay, let's put this here, and then we'll break in a minute. Let's finish the Dvar Torah. Oh my gosh, did she buy? He said buy one or two Danishes. She buys 12 Danishes.
Of course, of course.
Hi, women. Yes, I know. Just... okay, so go get the black plates and we can put them out. Yeah, go get the black plates. Is it your birthday? Every person that comes in, we're celebrating their birthday.
It's your birthday. It is today.
Right. The truth is, well, we'll get to that in a minute. I'll give another speech just on that. Adam is chosen, the word Adam, or the name Adam, the name of distinction for man, instead of just Ish, right? Right, anybody. Adam is because this person is already coming to the Kohen to find out what is the message that God's trying to tell me. I know that I failed, and obviously I need to learn something. That ability to be willing to reach out and to learn from what's happening to them, to oneself, especially for the Tsaras, is that takes a person. That takes a person of distinction. Because on Tsaras, if the Tsaras appears over here, what do? You wear long sleeve shirts. You never go outside in a t-shirt. right? Nobody would know.
Well, you're also basically not getting the message.
Unless the
tzaras
comes on your hands or on your face, you're okay. Nobody will ever know. But this person's going to the Kohen and saying, I got tzaras in somewhere, right? I got tzaras on my body somewhere.
The only way to rid yourself of it was to acknowledge it yourself.
Correct. Exactly. So that ability to acknowledge that itself takes a person of importance, a person of distinction, right? The person that's willing to admit that ability. Once you're willing to admit you have a flaw, then already God says, God distinguishes you as a person of distinction. God calls you Adam. This is a person. This is a real man. Right, that's willing to acknowledge. And the commentaries explain, so where's tzaras today? Where's tzaras today? So that answer is that we have a rule that once a problem becomes everybody's problem, God says, all right, that's not going to work over here. Right, meaning is the flaws of society or of humanity or of people has become so usual that God says I can't use that punishment anymore. It becomes you know, if everybody's going to walk around with tzaras, it's not going to mean anything anymore.
And nobody's going to acknowledge it.
And nobody's going to acknowledge it, so therefore as God says, that we're not going to do. There's an interesting Gemara, it's not exactly related to this point, but just an interesting idea. The Gemara Talmud asks, at the end of the Second Temple period, they suspended all capital cases. The great court no longer heard any more capital cases. Why? Because murder was prevalent. That's the Gemara. Murder was prevalent. Now, when I looked at Gemara, I didn't understand. The Talmud, if murder is prevalent, you better kill them faster. Mm-hmm. Right? So the answer is that the purpose of capital punishment was to create an aura of the sanctity of life and the importance. And when they would have a capital case, they would announce that there was a murder and this is going to be a big deal, and it would be in the papers that this is going to happen. Not the after pictures like you see today in our papers, but rather the build-up. Why? Because it was to create an understanding of the sanctity of life. And this only happens in the court once in 70 years. A whole thing. Once it's becoming commonplace, then it's just another murder. Right? Then that's just watching. Don't throw them in the garbage, though. Because then we won't have bags to get out of here. You can put them right there.
Rabbi, but with that attitude, that is just acquiescence.
Okay.
Isn't that word?
Okay, so no. There's no question that it would be... The Talmud is not telling us how we should react, but the Talmud was saying that it could no longer be the great court's actions. It could be you could have communities have to react. It could be the Besdin. Your local courts are going to have to do it. But the great court no longer wanted to be involved in it because it was no longer having the net effect that the great court system was supposed to have. Now, it could be the police have to deal with it. It could be it's a police problem. But it was not with the great aura that they wanted to accomplish. If it just becomes another murder, right, so then it would lose that effect. But they were trying to create, the Torah was trying, in this regard, was trying to create a certain impact effect. So too, by the tzaras was to create an impact effect on us as individuals and as people. Once that wasn't going to happen already, right, so Hashem says that punishment is no longer available. It's almost like, you know, you have to be on a spiritual level to get a spiritual call from God.
So then, well, when did that actually disappear?
I believe toward the also in the Second Temple period. Also in the Second Temple period. So that's an issue. But there's also why are there no prophets today? Right? It's also tied to this idea that we no longer have the spiritual level. The Rambam writes this, other commentaries explain, why are there no, there's also an idea called Shadim, which is demonic forces. Right? They're not necessarily the best word, but it's negative energy forces that were prevalent in the world of yesteryear. And we know today they're not around. So they still exist, but they're not able to surface. Why not? So it's the same. We're taught that it's the same idea, that you can only have negative energy if you can have positive energy of a high level. You can only have positive energy if God allows for a negative energy in the world. There's always a counterbalance. With the disappearance of prophecy, was it the disappearance of idolatry, or actually the disappearance of idolatry brought about the disappearance of prophecy. You can't, there always is a balance, because there always has to be a choice, right? In the Mashiach, when Messiah comes, there'll be no more reward and punishment. Why will there be no more reward and punishment? So we have a rule. Olam kimin hago noeg. The world will be like it was always. The world will still be a physical world. We're still going to have birthday parties. We're still going to eat. We're still going to have cake. Right? That's a reward. So the idea is, what it's referring to is, that once it becomes so clear what you should do, so there's no place for reward and punishment. Mm-hmm. If you know that if you touch the outlet, right, at about beyond 3 or 4 years old, if you know you touch the outlet, God forbid, you're going to get a shock. You're not going to touch the outlet.
But there was always the propensity for human beings to behave even though they knew right.
That's correct. So that's something to discuss. It could be that the Mashiach will not take away that. In fact, the way I understand is it will not take away that. The Gemara is only referring to... Should you cut the bagels? No, I think that, you know, we have a very talented group. So, okay. What was it?
The propensity for people to behave poorly, even
yeah.
though they.
I believe that when it's referring to that, there'll be no reward and punishment. It doesn't mean necessarily zero. What I believe it's referring to is there's still free choice, because that's inherent to life. But when something is so obvious, when God is going to manifest Himself in such an obvious fashion, right? The free will be reduced by that. By that obviousness of like touching the outlet, mm-hmm. all right? Or if you see the money, right, and it's all you have to do is pick up the gold from the street, right? So then obviously you're going to start picking up the gold because it's all over the street. You're going to want to have it. You're going to want to have it. So that's how I understand it. So this idea, there is an idea of a person has to see greatness in being able to recognize. Be able to recognize and admit where we're failing.
Rabbi, but with the Tzaraas, you can make the argument that it would still be a useful sign, because some people would pay attention to.
You're correct. But it seems to be once our spiritual level is no longer, meaning spirituality is not in a vacuum. So if you want God to react in a very direct fashion with you, you need to be in a very direct fashion with God, right? And either we're not capable of that, or nationally we're not. It doesn't go by one individual. It goes by national Israel. Right? This is a national issue. It's not a personal issue. Meaning, it doesn't matter. With Moshe Feinstein, none of the greatest of the rabbis would have this either, because there's certain that it's reduced by that. It says that the Talmud is filled with statements. This rabbi was fitting that God should have dwelled on him like he dwelled on other prophets, but the generation was not worthy. So there is a certain amount that we're all dragged down by society. Now, in the world to come, it's not like that.
By Jewish society.
Yeah. In the world to come, it's not like that. In the world to come, you are who you are, and you are based upon your push. So therefore, it could be that in this world, you may see yourself as very low, but in the next world, you're going to get a front row seat in the Garden of Eden. Why? Because your struggle was far harder than the struggle of people 400 years ago. So therefore, it says, they say over, that the Arizal said, this was in the 1400s, right? You can imagine today. He said that the spiritual worlds that you're building today is far greater than before because of the tests that exist. And if we multiply that a millionfold in the world that we live in today, right, which is a society where we're barraged with physicality and immorality, right? It's funny, I saw a line, I didn't realize the date. I had heard a statement from the Satmar Rav, one of the great Hasidic Rebbes. He said that today we are tested and barraged with immorality. A person sees, from when they leave their house till they get to the synagogue, sees more immorality in 5 minutes than we saw in Europe in our whole lifetime, in Satmar, in the city of Satmar, in the town of Satmar, right? Well, I had heard that statement, and I always understood it, I could understand it. What I didn't realize is he said this in 1956.
Oh my God.
I thought he had said it in 70, because he had passed away in the 70s. I thought he had said it in the 70s. He had said it in 56, so you can only imagine what he would say today. And that's the challenge and the test of our society today.
Now we'll take it. We're starting. I think the lens is falling apart because we started or something.
Okay.
I just have one question. Given the level of spirituality back in those days,
yes.
What was the per capita incidence of Saras, and also how many people would we understand acknowledged it, given that level of spirituality?
I had that question. I didn't see the answer to that question. I hadn't seen the answer. I know that it existed. I know that there's discussions of it existing and people that had it, but I don't know. We can also have to put a different
and Rabbi,
Wait, this is like the most used birthday ever.
I'm a twin.
Surprise!
Surprise! Happy birthday!
Happy birthday!
See, we're both twins.
Mother, for you.
And Rabbi, one day.
It was for you.
Rabbi, one day if you could address, if the righteous could be dragged down by the...
Okay, now we're going to break in a minute for the happy birthday cake.
Fresh vegetables.
I'm sorry. From New York.
From New York.
I can't believe this. I came hungry. I was trying to get here, and I'm really hungry today. I'm like, whoa, and then here.
Natalie, we figured we didn't need another cake yesterday.
Is this your birthday? Is it your birthday?
No, it was.
It's hers.
And we're both twins.
I know.
Mommy. Okay, this is also besides...
North Korea is so much more than Libya. What do you mean Libya? North Korea kills the people. He's starving these people in a mass concentration camp every day.
Careful. We're focusing on Libya. President Orange.
Okay.
What can you do? What can you do?
All right. Now we're on to. Okay. Let's. I'm glad everybody enjoyed the bagels. Now let's go back to work. Okay.
Yes. Let's go back to Adam.
With that, we could go now to our introduction. Okay. With this, we begin our class with the discussion, or what we just discussed now actually fits very well to our discussion of the Seder. Why? Because whereas Shabbos, right, the seventh day of the week is the Shabbos. What does Shabbos celebrate? Shabbos celebrates God as the creator. Hey, buddy. Go over there to that side. We're learning now. Shh.
Buddy.
God as the creator of the universe. Hashem is the creator of the universe. Pesach is now going to celebrate God as the entity that's involved in the world until this very day. That's why, right, what is God's introduction to humanity? Right, when God introduced himself to at Sinai to the Jewish people, I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt. Because what's critically important is why the Seder is so celebrated is because this is the point where God says, I care about the world. And that's why it's so important. We've talked about this many times. And that is the message, what we're supposed to give over at the Seder. Meaning, why is the Seder so important? Is it the matzah bowls? I mean, what is so important about having a Seder?
Freedom.
Right? Right? So what that idea is, freedom is secondary. It's not first.
Birth of a nation.
Freedom is... The first point is that God is sending us a message that he cares about us.
Yeah.
That's the most important message. Once you're important, then we can already discuss, okay, so what should I do? But if you're a nobody, that's why the basis of all, of everything, of Judaism, is you have to first have self-esteem. If you don't have self-esteem, then Judaism doesn't begin. Yeah, it begins with self-esteem. That was the idea of building people up. In Europe, the idea is if you have self-esteem, then what I do is important, right? Adam was called Adam. Why? Because Adameh, I will compare myself. I will emulate. I mean, God. Because we're supposed to thrive and strive toward becoming godly. Interestingly, rabbis they say over. That had Darwin met Rabbi Saul Salanter, they lived at the same time, he never could have posited the idea of evolution. Because Rabbi Saul Salanter was such a man of sanctity and saintliness that there is no way that he could have evolved from a monkey. It's an expression, it's an idea.
If who had met him?
If Darwin had met Rabbi Saul Salanter, he never could have posited or even thought that man can come from from animal.
I was just reading Rabbi Salanter's The 13.
Right.
I was sitting there, like, sort of, you know, put in my place once. It was great. I want to print that out.
Right. That's step one of the Seder. So when you're sitting down to the Seder, what God is telling us as a people, and was telling the world, right? Because that message of Exodus was sent, a message that was sent around the world. It was the shot that was heard around the world. The only difference is, and this we talked about when we talked about Jethro, when we talked about Yisro, is that most people said what, and then they went back to watching television. Right? Which is what most of us happens with, really most of us in our lives, right? We get this message, and then we change the station. Or then we go back to watch the TV. Whatever we're doing. Because people have a tendency not to change. Whatever I was doing yesterday is what I plan on doing tomorrow. So that we sit down to the Seder. Now, the Seder was designed in what structure? The Rambam says very clearly, and this is the most difficult, and this I don't know yet myself, how to fully achieve this desired state of fulfilling the mitzvah of the Seder. I don't know myself. It says, the Rambam says, Chayiv Adam liharos es atzmo, Ki'ilu ata hu yotze mimitzrayim, which translates Chayav Adam, a person is obligated leharos es atzmo, to display himself, to show himself ki'ilu ata, like now I am going out from Egypt. The Seder is to be designed to show yourself as if you are going out from Egypt now. Now that's very difficult. I don't know. I myself am bothered by this.
Well, we lean. We have someone else serve us, right?
So you are really supposed to. So it's not, you're not simply remembering what was. You are re-experiencing what was. And therefore, we're supposed to design our Seder to literally feel as if we're going, we remember the slavery and we are experiencing the freedom. And that's a different level. That's not just raising up the wine glass and toasting. Right? That's not enough. Now you know why you don't come to the
game. I don't remember who wrote it. I think it was in the Jewish Journal. But anyway, this person takes a chair, an empty chair, and puts a sign on it and commemorates the empty chair to all the people in our world today that can't observe their religious freedom and are persecuted, and so it brings it into your house. And
That's good, but that's, you're bringing a message of collective suffering, which is important, right? But first we have to get to first base. First we have to get to ourselves to first base, right? Meaning, what are we doing to make our Seder, right, what it needs to be? Right, meaning our Seder is that we are supposed to actively feel that we ourselves are enslaved and now are experiencing freedom. Wow. Right, now it could be what you mean by the chair is that they're experiencing slavery, so maybe that's shared by us.
Okay,
that
could be awareness.
That's important. I want to focus is that we have to first understand what are we supposed to experience before we feel with the other what they cannot experience. Okay. Right, so we really have to process and realize what it is that the Seder is supposed to bring about. We're supposed to bring about a feeling of bondage and now experiencing freedom, right? And purposeful freedom, right? Meaning we're going free for a reason, right? It's not simply that we don't have the tyrant Pharaoh upon us. In the Seder, what do we say? B'chol davadar, every generation, right? Because if God did not take us out from Egypt, we would be slaves to Pharaoh in Mitzrayim, in Egypt. Yeah. I don't understand. That's just not probably historically true. Why? Because even if God didn't take us out from Egypt, there is a rule in history that history has ups and it downs. It moves. It does not stay stagnant. No empire has ever survived the test of time. There's only one nation that survived the test of time, right? It's the Jewish, right? That's what I believe it was Tonby wrote, that his great anger is that the Jews did not fit his theory of history. I think it was Arnold Toynbee, if I remember. Right? He had a theory of how history evolves, and the Jews are the only nation that doesn't fit that theory.
That's what it doesn't fit. Like it.
Yeah.
And they didn't like it. But they didn't work. It didn't work because the Jews are still around. That's what Mark Twain says, right? Everything is mortal, save the Jews. Right? The Jews, they're just around. They just continue to exist. Right? So therefore, history, we would not be slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt. Right? History would have evolved. So what does that mean? What it's talking about is we would still be slaves to some Pharaoh. Meaning freedom, when we talk about freedom, right, what does that mean to be free? Well, what does it truly mean to be free? It means that I am not enslaved to myself. I'm not enslaved to my own personal passion, my own personal desire, right? I can make a free decision independent of the crushing burden that either my own self wants or that society wants me to make.
Yes.
Right? That's true freedom. The ability to truly decide what is really what I want. Right? We live in a society that's enslaved to the passion. Right? Enslaved to passion. I saw great on the tea bags in the house. So some of the tea bags have a saying. So one of them is a very good saying. The art of marketing is suspending logic long enough to make a sale.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The art of marketing is suspending logic long enough to make a sale.
That's assuming you don't need the product, the goods or services.
Okay.
That's
okay.
Assuming
okay.
That.
Yes, that's good.
That's
good.
They're telling you
right.
Need
right.
It.
Right. They're telling you you're enslaved, right?
No.
Now,
and the Jews,
you know,
junk.
It's funny.
I'm
I want to understand, everybody, the greatest of that, and I don't mean this with any hurt feelings to Apple, but what in the world? So I was sitting next to somebody the other day. Okay, nobody's here that was at that meeting, right? And see, the person has an iPad 2, right? What did you need the iPad 2? Right? Are you talking to the machine from the face up? It only works from one side, not two sides, whatever. I mean, what in the world are you doing?
As opposed to the iPad 1 or at all?
iPad 1. The person had an iPad 1.
Apple will even acknowledge.
Maybe
though,
they never
it
had the iPad
1.
But the person came in. He couldn't. He could no longer use the iPad 1 because the iPad 2 was out. He's enslaved. I would ask. He's enslaved.
I actually considered getting it, but.
Because
you're
free.
Agree.
You're free.
Well, what if he never had an iPad?
Well, but.
No, I have nothing wrong with getting it. But
Apple will acknowledge that.
Okay. I'm glad that they will admit that. But it's just fascinating. So a person is, that's a trivial matter.
Right.
Okay, but I'm just trying to use it as an example.
Sense.
Right, to be enslaved, right, a person has to be able, what is freedom? Freedom is the ability to make a sound and rational decision. Not to be, Egypt, right, what is Egypt? Egypt represents the idea, Egypt was an immoral nation. It was an enslaved nation to passion, right? What is it, Mitzrayim? What does the word Mitzrayim mean?
No.
It means to be constrained,
right.
To be restricted. That's why it says no slave. There's a Medrash says no slave ever escaped Egypt, right? Now, what does that Medrash mean? What does it mean no slave ever escaped? Mentally. What God was trying to break, and you see God had trouble. Even God had trouble breaking the Jewish people from the culture of Egypt. They were so enmeshed, they were so tied to it. There's an expression, right? What was Choshech the Makkah of Choshech the Makkah, the plague of darkness? So we have an expression that 4/5 of the Jewish people died in the plague of darkness. Only 1/5 went out. What does that mean? What does that mean 1/5 of the Jewish people went out? Right, the answer is only 1/5 wanted to go out.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The other 4/5,
wow.
We're happy here.
And speaking of that, piggyback on that, I look at the 60s and my personal experience with people with, sex, drugs, rock and roll, the me generation and all that, and now today, people look to use, drugs and alcohol and anesthetize themselves. Talk about freedom. They're volunteering to ruin their brains and anesthetize themselves and... That's why it's so such a sin and it, all. But they're looking to do that.
I do recommend.
But why? I have seen on this channel once, you know, the learning channel, that they were telling you the drugs was good.
Right, well, Tom Timothy Leary.
That's another challenge. Oh, that's another challenge. I had that this week. I did ask somebody on this issue. It's a difficult issue, the drugs issue.
It's mind-blowing. They try to see the, like, Timothy Leary spoke at Stony Brook, you know.
In everything they do, you know.
Talking about drugs, I do recommend, and we're going to talk about having a Haggadah and preparing for the Seder in a minute, but in the Haggadah of Dr. Tversky, did I say this last week?
I apologize
if I did, I'm sorry. In Dr. Tversky's book, so Dr. Abraham Tversky is the world-renowned expert on drug rehabilitation.
Oh.
Right, literally a world-renowned expert on it. He has many clinics that he started. In his, not for the world, not necessarily for Jews, in general. And he writes there that he had a Seder, well, he always has a Seder, but at the Seder he had a number of people that were from the clinic at the Seder. And one of the people from, so he's talking about, he said this statement that I just said, you are obligated to see yourself as a slave to Pharaoh in Egypt, as your slaves, and you're going free, right? And that's what the Seder is all about. So one person asked at the Seder, he asked, can I please speak? So said, you want to speak? Speak. So the person says, with all respect to you, that Rabbi Doctor, and everybody here, you do not understand what it means to have a master and what it means to be a slave. Right? He says, I know what it means to be a slave. Because I was a slave to drugs.
But doesn't Rabbi, he would understand that because he's opened his clinics.
He tells him, he says, a master is, you have no choice. Mm-hmm. You are a slave. You have no freedom.
That would
he
be
says,
the no
it
drug
tells you what to
sober,
do.
Though.
It tells you what, right? Yes. And he expressly says, he says, I understand what it meant to be a slave. Right, and I understand what it means to go free because he was rehabilitated.
Mm-hmm.
He was already broken from, he'd already come back. But he says that is slavery, right? You have no choice whatsoever. Right? That's what we have to understand when we're going to the Seder. God is telling us you have an opportunity to make a choice. Right? God gave us the tools and the ability to be free, to make a decision. But what does it mean? How could we celebrate the Seder? Natalie talked about having that extra chair, which is beautiful. But how did they celebrate the Seder in the Warsaw Ghetto? How did they celebrate the Seder throughout history? Right? Remember, we are a blip on the screen of history. The way you see world events today, as of recent, in the last year and 2 years, and with the anti-Semitism becoming in vogue, forget about popular, just in vogue, right? That was the way it was for the last 2,000 years. Right. We were a blip. This last 50 years, okay, was not normal. I'm sorry to tell you. It was not normal. It doesn't sit any student of history. It does not have any period in history. I heard this from Rabbi Wein many times. In the golden era of Spain was not even a reflection of the United States, the gift that we'd be given to the United States. But and that was the golden era of Spain, which had a prime minister that was Jewish, right? We have to understand that. So how do you have free? The answer is that the true freedom that the Haggadah is talking about is not limited to physical emancipation. It is far more critical in expressing to us that we have the ability to be mentally and spiritually free.
Well, that's what Viktor Frankl said, having lived through the concentration
that's
camp,
that's right.
That his attitude was the only thing that they couldn't break, right?
Break was
the spirit.
Right, was the spirit. And was that unique ability, I mean, just the incredible stories of the Jews in the Holocaust, right? I'll share with you a story. You talk about the Pesach Seder, right? There was a Jew that he one of his jobs was he went every day. He was on the part of the work effort. So they would go outside the ghetto during the week to be slave works, and then they would come back in the labor camps, and he would go outside the ghetto to work, and then he would come back. So what he did is he decided he was not going to be robbed of the mitzvah of matzah, And every day he would bring in a drop of flour. Somehow he found a little flour outside the camp, and he would bring in a drop of flour, and that would add up to be able to make matzah for he and whoever was around him for the Seder. And of course, as you know, if the Nazis caught you with anything that you weren't allowed, you were killed or beaten till you were killed. Sooner than you would be, right. So this guy, he went every day, I think his name was Ramesha, and he would bring in a little more until he finally had brought in all that he needed. Right? And then one Jew asked him, this was 2-3 days before Passover, one someone asked him, can you get me a little bit more flour? So he says, okay, I'll do it one more time. And sure enough, that time on the way home was the only time, was that time he was caught. So the Nazis beat him till he was almost dead, and they beat his face, and they had knocked out all of his teeth in the merciless beating. So he was brought home. Afterwards, the Jews carried him from the commandant to his home, and he was crying profusely. So they asked him, so he was crying. So they brought the Rebbe, they brought one of the rabbis in the ghetto to see him. So he told the Rebbe, I'm not crying over the pain, right? I'm only crying because if I don't have teeth, I cannot eat the matzah, right? And he was afraid that the Nazis would win, right? So that's what he was crying for. So it was just an amazing, amazing, amazing level. Right, you're talking about that's a person that's free. Right, his body may be enslaved to the Nazis, but they could not. He is free. Right, and that's the spiritual freedom that we have to aspire to at the Seder. But yes, it's also to see and to think, as Natalie said, 100%. It is to experience the physical side of the slavery. To think about the fact that yes. There are people that are not going to be able to celebrate the Seder as we are fortunate enough, right? They don't have, they weren't given that physical freedom to be able to celebrate. We also have to have a chair, right? And Natalie spoke about those that are choosing not to have, I'm sorry, those that are not able to have a Seder, Gilad Shalit, who's been over, I think, 1,734 days in enslavement. And you have Jonathan Pollard, which has no precedent in American history. In his enslavement at this point already. The boys in Japan. Right. The boys in Japan. And but there's a second chair that needs to be there, right? Perhaps more, I don't say perhaps more tragically, but in a certain way more tragically, is the millions that are not choosing to be at the Seder. I mean, they don't know what they need to choose. They don't know what they're missing. However you want to word it, right? The majority of the nation will not be having a Seder. We should understand that. But, we should understand what that means, right? The majority of Jews, I believe, will not be sitting at a Seder by choice, right? And that's something. It may not be something that we can do anything about, but it's something that we have to at least cry about it. It has to be in our hearts. Right, just like we have to have two chairs at the Seder.
It's amazing to me that the United States can give aid, all this aid, outpouring of aid to Japan, who is devastated, and they need aid when they have prisoners of war. Right? They should have to preach. I know it's Israel; it's not Americans, Middle East, and all that. But it's amazing that they can even have prisoners of war and we're giving them aid.
The boys is a complicated case. I mean, it's a difficult, but it's a
two wrongs don't make a right.
I mean, they give aid to the Arabs.
It's a humanitarian issue.
No, I know, and that's also. Right, no, of course.
All of these issues are very great, great challenges.
It's heartbreaking.
Okay. We have to, one of the keys to a successful Seder is really, there's two parts to the Seder. One is everybody else at the Seder, and one is ourselves, right? And by that I mean that you have to prepare for a successful Seder. Right, just like there is it has to be a team effort. Just like the house has to be cleaned, right? There's food has to be cooked for the Seder, matzah has to be bought for the Seder. So too, there needs to be leftover or or even perhaps more importantly, reserved time to prepare for the Seder in the sense of thoughts to say or thoughts to share, right? And a person should write out, prepare 10 things to say at the Seder, right? It should be short things, short thoughts, things to throw out, spices to share, right? That's one. And secondly is for yourself. You when you read through Haggadah, you can't read. When I say read, I mean there are many, many Haggadahs out there. I'm not talking about the Maxwell House. The Maxwell House is a good translation, but it's not a Haggadah with thought. Today, the number one book printed by Art Scroll is Haggadahs. Right? The number one book printed in the world is Haggadahs, in terms of commentaries. There's a plethora, there's a tremendous number of Haggadahs from the most in-depth to the most easy. Right? From a children's level Haggadah all the way to the most advanced Haggadahs. Right? Person should have several of them, right? And each year you read through a different one. And that's not only at the Seder, it's throughout the entire holiday of Passover. I mean, that should be your reading, right? You stop reading, right? It's actually a piece of the Talmud. But you suspend your study of what you normally study on the holiday, and you, before when the holiday comes, you suspend your normal readings, and you study about the holiday. So throughout the Seder, you should read, throughout the entire Passover holiday, preferably before also, so you have what to say. And you have what to think about at the Seder. But also throughout the entire holiday of Passover, you should be reading through the Haggadah. That should be your study. And that's your study. Right? Each year you pick a different one. Right? Each year you pick a different Haggadah. And you read through it, because each Haggadah will have a style. Right? And you'll see, you'll understand it on that level. That's the way Judaism is. There's many levels to understand it.
If I can... I'm taking the spotlight of being... I just realized I had a picture of my niece when she was 5, and she was looking through. She, unbeknownst to her, I took a picture, and she's reading her handmade Haggadah, and she's
amazing.
Sitting there with her little picture.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
That's so great. I learned from them, these little pages.
And the truth is that's what we all should
that's
be preparing. We should all be, you know, unfortunately, our greatest undoing is that we feel we've been there, done that. Right? And what's very interesting is, what does we say at the beginning of the Haggadah? Right? A very strange statement we say, even if we were all wise men, even if we were all scholars, even if we were all advanced, we have an obligation to talk about the Haggadah in depth. Why is that there? I mean, like, why is that there? I mean, do we have such advanced people at all of our seders?
Yeah.
The answer is that because people tend to be been there, done that, right? There's no excitement to the Seder, right? We all know what's coming, you know, this, the Manashtana. So what's the answer is that what we're missing out is, what we don't recognize is that the excitement, we have to experience it like this is the first time. We have to experience it like this is the first time. Because in a certain level, it is a first time. Every moment of life, every moment is a different level of experiencing. And especially as we study more, as we understand more, and that's why it's afilu, right, is that it increases our ability, right? We have to stop being a been there, done that. We have to remember, forget what we learned in Hebrew school, right, in a certain way, and be prepared to become so much more studious, learning and re-experiencing the Haggadah.
I would challenge anyone here to judge themselves and say, what am I a slave to? And we can all look at, I can look at myself and say, I can say two things for me. I say, wow, if I don't get that under control, I'm still a slave to that. Right? And I'm sure we can each pick out something.
I'm a slave to Natalie.
Nothing else.
See, you missed your whole thing.
Sweet
Natalie.
Right.
There's only one problem.
No,
I just says, are you praying to go free?
Just answer the joke. Right. So, right? So that's how I look at it, saying, if I'm still a slave to anything.
Right. It's interesting when we talk about going free. What Don is raising, when we talk about going free is, but remember, it never says, right, and this is an important point also to throw it at the Seder, is what whenever Moses, we all know the famous line, let my people go, right? Right? Shalach et ami, let my people go. That's the most famous call of Passover. But that actually, it never says, let my people go without one more word. V'yavduni, so that they could serve God.
Oh, yeah.
There was always a direct connection, because freedom, unbridled freedom, is absolutely destructive. A person, when a person, when we say, if you, when you're free to do whatever you want,
chaos.
You have chaos. There has to be a certain built-in godliness that then tells you, is okay, how do I use this gift of freedom? Because what's anarchy? Anarchy is ultimate freedom, but the problem is when you have anarchy, you have no society. Right? If everybody decides, well, the stoplight doesn't apply to me, right? Nothing works. Right? And nothing works. So the answer is you need that balance of shalah. You need the freedom and then the self, the ability to have the restraint that godliness instills in us.
What was that quote again?
He said, shalach et ami v'yavduni. Send out, God, Moses is speaking on behalf of God, and he says this a number of times. Send out my people and they will serve me. Right? And therefore, is that's why Passover immediately begins a count. Well, what are we beginning the count to? Because the count is, we have the physical freedom has to be coupled with the spiritual freedom, which is Shavuos. Right? Which is the holiday of Shavuos. So it's coupled. They're not two independent holidays. They're sisters. Right? One completes the other. And that's why we have the counting of the Omer. The 50-day count, right, is bridging. Right? It gives us the purpose of the freedom. It's not the freedom was only the ability so that we can then stand at Sinai. Right, that's why there's five cups at the Haggadah. We drink four. Right, right. What's the right, right? So what's this way? Right, we have I will take you out of Egypt. V'itzalti, I will save you from the enslavement. V'ga'alti, I will redeem you. I'm not going in order. I'm sorry. V'ga'alti, I will redeem you from the slavery. And then finally, v'lakachti li'la'am, I will take you for a people. Those are the four. So the culmination cup that we drink at the Haggadah, at the Seder, is the purpose to our freedom. The fifth cup, which we don't drink, which is Elijah's cup, is ve'vesi, which is the connection to the land of Israel. Right? That fifth cup we don't have in its complete form. So we don't drink the fifth cup. We were gifted again in 48 with the land of Israel, but we don't have it in its full form. Right, we still have all of the problems that we have, and therefore we don't drink the fifth cup. But we have part of the four cups is, it's part of it, the fourth cup is that there's the freedom of the beginning of the Seder has to be coupled with the Velokachti, which is the spiritual freedom, which is that we God took us for a people, that we stood at Sinai. The Sinai experience is coupled, that's one of the four cups that we drink. Right, because again, that is the culmination of all of it. But that gives us the purpose of it. When we're at the Seder, right? So let's try to take a moment to try to take a point going through, right, the messages of the items. Remember, ritual only has a place in Judaism if you're absorbing its message. Absolute commandments have a place. If it's a biblical commandment, it's a biblical commandment. But minhag, custom, is only rich if it's speaking to you. If it's not speaking to you, then you need to listen to its message. It doesn't do anything, right, without its message. Right? Therefore, when you're going through the Haggadah, you have to open yourself up to absorb its message. And again, that's why we say it's critical to have a Haggadah that's easy to use and has perhaps highlights in it. There's so many beautiful ones out there. Or you prepare highlights so that you can be able to absorb, right? Why four cups, right? Why are there matzos, right? The transformation of the matzos, right? What are we supposed to, what are we taking, little tidbits that we're supposed to be taking from that goddess so that that goddess speaks to us, right? That's not simply, right? The challenge is, by many of the sages is, right? When are we going to eat, right? And therefore, he says that you have to see the meal as the icing on the cake, as the reward. But it cannot be the purpose of the Seder. Because if that was the purpose of the Seder, so what do you need the Seder for? You have the rest of the holiday, we don't have a Seder. Seder is only the first night or the first two nights in the diaspora. Right? The rest of the nights, we go straight to the meal. Kiddush, meal. Right? Straight to 1-2, 1-2, 1-2. Every Shabbos, 1-2, 1-2. It's only a Seder only comes once or twice a year. We're blessed. We live in America. So we get to have two Seders. Right? In Israel, unfortunately, I say this tongue in cheek, right? They only have one Seder. They got to get it right the first time. Right? We're blessed, right? Right? One of the great rebbes once said, he says, the consolation of the diaspora is that I get to have two seders. I get two chances. So really, we have to realize it's an opportunity. It's an opportunity. And that's why in the community seder, I tell people, eat a little bit before you come. Don't stuff yourself, because it'll be a beautiful meal. But, you know, prepare yourself, right, so that you're open to the experience that you're about to have. Right? Prepare yourself. This is an opportunity. It's a golden opportunity to experience the Seder. Right? And to emerge. Right? And to absorb its message. And we have to prepare ourselves and open ourselves up. Right? Most people, the greatest challenge is that they walk into most things of life with the wrong mindset. If you walk in with a certain mindset, a realistic but a real mindset, then usually you're prepared for the experience. Right? I once heard a very strong line at a rabbinic conference that I went to. So they had one of the speakers was a speaker that they were able to get a Jewish, very, very popular speaker. I apologize, I don't remember his name. One of these very celebrated time management or these types of individuals, you know, that speak. It costs $600-$800 to get into the class for the day. One of those. So he came to speak. So I remember I was next to him. So he said something very interesting. He says, you know, I noticed, he says, your rabbis are very busy people. He says, but there's something to learn. He says, when I give the seminar in the work world, in the regular world, he says, I walk in at 9 o'clock, it starts. He says, when I walk in at 9 o'clock, he says, hundreds of chairs are filled. Right? He says, there's no such thing. He says, he never has that. He walked after he begins. He says, of course, I think it was even more than $600-$700 for his sake. Right? He says, it's exactly. He says, everybody's got their computers or their pads out. Everybody's ready. Right? He says, there's a certain amount. He says, here, we're coming. We're all walking in. But he says, what's the explanation? And it says, they shelled out a lot of money to be there. And that creates a certain amount of investment creates a certain amount of mental focus that they're ready for the experience. And they're going to do everything that they can to maximize what they can draw out from it. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing by the Seder. If we want to draw out from the Seder, we need to make an investment. So we just have to ask ourselves, we have to be prepared to make an investment, right? Right, to gain out from the Seder. Now, yes, a part of that investment is, right, especially on the ladies' part, is the preparing the house. That's a tremendous investment, right? Right. But there also has to be an investment. There has to be an investment of our mental when we walk into the Seder, right? We have to prepare an investment into the Seder so that we are ready when we walk in. But the way you walk into something to be prepared is not saying, okay, I'm ready. No. It's by the investment is preparing for it, right? Read a little bit about the Haggadah before you get in there. Start preparing. Start thinking of questions. Think of, okay, how can I experience the Seder to the maximum? Because when you prepare for something, you have a far deeper experience, right? And that's the message that I share with you this week is that let's start getting in and preparing ourselves for the Haggadah, preparing ourselves for Pesach and for the Seder so we can really draw out from our experience. With Hashem's help, next week, God willing, we're going to give our class on preparing the home for Passover, which is and some of the technical laws of the kitchen and all of these things. That will be our class, God willing, next week, as well as additional insights for us all to share. I wish you have a fantastic week and a happy birthday to Mom and to Natalie, and a thank you to our great committee. The question was why in the Parsha, at the beginning of the Parsha, you have that a woman, after she gives birth, so she becomes tamei. She becomes ritually unclean. So the word unclean is a English translation. It's not really the word. Tamei is the opposite. Tamei is the lack of purity. What does that mean in Jewish terms, not in the English language? The way Tumah works is Tumah is the absence of life. Whenever you have the absence of life, that vacuum is filled with something called Tumah. Where do you find it? In the simplest form is the most Tameh thing in the world is a dead body. Why? Because the answer is because it is absence of life. Right? That's simple. That same idea is after a woman gives birth, there's an absence of life. What do you mean there's an absence of life? Because till now, the baby was inside. Mm-hmm. Now the baby is out. Now is that the goal? You should never confuse goal with just the technicals. Right? Of course that was the goal. Baby can't stay in. Okay? But right now, when the baby leaves the mother has an absence. Right? It's almost like postpartum depression.
Oh, how right? beautiful.
I mean, there's an absence of life. So therefore, the tumor immediately fills the void. Right? It's a natural evolution. It's not a question of clean or unclean. That's a problem. The English language is a problem. You have to use the word Hebrew. Tameh, tuma exists in the absence. It fills the vacuum of life. The absence of life. The same thing, right? And that same explanation explains why by a baby girl is there twice as much tum'ah as by a baby boy.
Watch out, because we're more important.
Okay.
Oh my gosh.
Nothing unusual. The absence of tum'ah. But the girl. Why? Because the girl is the receptacle, has the seeds for future life.
Wow.
Directly. Right, directly, the girl has the seeds for future life, so therefore, there's twice as much tumah. It's a natural, the vacuum is double as much vacuum. And therefore, the Torah introduces us that there's double tumah. That's how it's beautifully explained.
So it's not, it has nothing to do with the child.
No. It has nothing to do with the child.
Right. So my statement
the child
stands.
Is pure.
The child is pure.
Yeah, the child is not tumah. It's not that type of tumah. Okay. The child...
Yeah, explain that to me, that one.
Okay, so let's talk about why is it that we'll talk about the same, it's the same idea, it's all the same thing. Why is it that a woman has the laws of Nida, which means when a woman gets her period, so during that period, she is Tameh. Mm-hmm.
Right.
So the world has translated it as unclean, right? And the purpose of the mikvah is because she has to get clean. So therefore, people have written that once we have showers and we have baths, and it's commonplace to bathe every day, you don't need the mikvah, right? Which is nonsense, because it has nothing to do with being clean. If you're clean, you have to go to the temple. But they have baths in the olden days, too. They had showers in the olden days. Okay, showers, I don't know, but they have baths in the olden days. There's nothing to do with that. When a woman gets her period, what was, is that the eggs, right, are going out, right? So that potential for life is not used. It's not good or bad. It's nothing to do with good or bad. Don't use the word clean. Don't use the word good or bad. It's nothing to do. It's tum'ah is the absence. It's the vacuum that fills. Tum'ah fills the vacuum when life leaves, or potential seeds of life leave.
Okay.
Right? It's the same thing by a man also, by the way. By a man, different laws, but the same idea. Right? When a man has relations or spills seed, right, he becomes tamei. Different ways of purification, but the same law. Why? It has nothing to do. It could be that he spilled seed to have a baby. Not spilled seed. That's the reason we spilled seed.
You know,
he had relations to have a baby, let's say. And you know that was the time they had the baby.
You know, speaking of showers not being clean or unclean for women, I just struck me the most perverse thing just is that with men, when they have the community that uses the bathhouses. You'd think cleanliness, but that's the most, right? What about a paradox? The most impure thing you could ever.
But before
conceive.
A woman goes to the mikvah, she has to first take a bath for a half an hour.
Well,
the idea of the same thing when a husband has relations, the relation that has the baby also becomes tamei. Why? Because it's leaving, the life force is leaving him, and entering into her.
There's also a connection that I read about to Eve, that because she was the original.
Okay, so I have to get first. Okay. Fine. Okay, we'll get more later. Yes, I'm sorry.
That the connection to Eve was because she originally sinned.
Yes.
And the whole thing with the Soras.
Correct.
Well, that
because
was why
of her,
the child
that there was death in the world, loss of life,
yes.
And also women experience pain during childbirth.
Yes.
And so a woman sins, perhaps, during childbirth and says, I'm never going to have relations with my
husband. Right. That's another. That's the idea of the chatas. Yes, I said yesterday. I offered a different understanding. Yes. The Gemara's answer is, the Gemara says a simple answer. But again, all of the this is drush, which means the shemat, meaning the money levels to understand it. So additional insight is that she might have swore that she's not going to have.
Right. Becomes like snake
right.
Because
snake. Right. Right. So all of these are different ideas. All of them are multi-layered truths. One is not mutually exclusive of the other. They're all multi-layered truths.
I know. That just was
interesting.
Karsten and I read in the Chumash yesterday, and I interpreted it as the baby not being pure. And I said, that's not possible.
The baby is so pure.
I know.
But you see, in Christianity,
right.
Oh,
a baby is born sinned.
Right. Yeah, so born a sinner.
Born, not a sinner, sinned, had already sinned.
You already sinned before coming into this world.
Well, they sinned by having a baby, right?
Yeah, I think it is coming through the birth canal.
Oh, you're right, even having sex is sinned, you're right.
Right.